Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app, Star One Credit Union, in your best interest. Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
When Oscar season rolls around, everybody's trying to catch up on the big movies. But there's rarely buzz about the short films, especially the short documentary category. This year, two joyful California films made the nominee list. Nai Nai and Waipo is a love letter from a grandson to his two grandmothers. And The Last Repair Shop looks at the people behind the scenes who fix instruments for students learning music in the LA Unified School District.
This is not just a musical instrument repair shop. When an instrument breaks, there's a student without an instrument. No, not in our city.
We know it could change their whole life.
I'm Sasha Coca, and today on the California Report magazine, we're going to talk with the filmmakers from both of these films. We'll start with the film based in Los Angeles, The Last Repair Shop. It was actually produced by a filmmaker who learned music as a student in LA Unified and played on instruments repaired in that shop. And you can hear the passion the young musicians featured in the film have for their instruments, like Manuel, who's a senior in high school and plays the sousaphone.
I could never have at that age an instrument that expensive. I used to beg my mom and my dad, I used to beg them to buy me one. And they're always telling me the same thing. Me decían, o la tuba o tú, which means either a tuba or you in the house. And I'm just like, oh, well. But luckily, I had a sousaphone at home from school.
This film is actually directed by two LA-based filmmakers, Chris Bowers and Ben Proudfoot, who join us now to talk about The Last Repair Shop. You know, at the beginning of this film, I thought it was going to be about the kids and maybe about their music teachers. But really, this story is about the people behind the scenes who repair these instruments. Ben, tell us, how did the idea for this film come about? How did you find this story?
It was an old article from maybe 10 years ago about how there was a backlog at this shop. And it was a bit of a profile of the different repair people there. And I just, something about it was just like, I want to see that place. I want to feel it. I want to hear what it sounds like in a musical instrument repair shop, just this North Pole of musical instruments. And I remember reading that it was the last in the country. And I asked Chris, I said, you know, you went to LAUSD. Have you ever heard of this shop? And he hadn't.
Not only had I not heard of it, but I also never thought about it. I never thought about how those instruments that I played so much were kept in good condition. So for me, this was also exciting to get to know a bit more about, you know, a part of my own history I actually didn't even know was there until now.
Chris, we should say you learned piano in LAUSD. You went on to Juilliard, and you've become a composer for films like The Color Purple, Green Book, and shows like Bridgerton. And one of the amazing things you learned in making this film is that the supervisor of the repair shop actually tuned the piano that you played as a kid.
I started as a piano technician. I always remember the first time I saw the piano.
There's 6,000 pianos in the district, and you know, for him to tune those that I played is pretty pretty special moment.
And you guys have really fascinating backstories in this film about the people who the students might not ever meet, but they're the people who make sure that the kids have the opportunity to play the instruments. You got the guy who fixes the woodwinds, Dwayne Michael. He's actually a fiddler who played with a group called the Bodie Mountain Express. And their manager was actually the same manager who managed Elvis. Then you've got these immigrants who've overcome so much in this country and are really finding their way through fixing instruments. I love the story of Patty Moreno, who came from Mexico, and at one point she couldn't even afford to rent an instrument for her own son.
My son, he said, "Mom, I would like to try clarinet. $20 a month, the rental. It was a lot for me. I was a single mom, remember? And I couldn't afford it. I came to this country thinking, yes, this is the American dream. And when I didn't have food for my kids, I thought, like, this is not an American dream."
Yeah, so Patty's a single mom and has two beautiful kids and, you know, came here from Mexico, and she, you know, struggled for a little while, but found a job at an instrument rental shop. And it was at that shop that she not only started to get a lot of her experience, you know, cleaning the instruments and vacuuming cases and doing a little bit of repairs, but she also met a colleague who told her about the central shop, about the repair shop, the LAUSD repair shop. And she went down to audition. She was the only woman to audition. She also is still now the only woman working at the shop. And the thing that I really love about Patty's story is that one of the things she mentions is this secret communication that they have between themselves and these students. And for her, it comes in the form of this treasure jar that has all of these little trinkets and toys and bits of candy that kids have dropped into the instruments.
Batteries, marbles, candies, pencils, erasers. It's like secret communication between the kid and myself.
It's this way of having some sort of physical representation of that connection between the two of them. Her story really is about what you will do for your children and how much you will, you know, work as hard as possible to make sure that you can provide for them. And you know, she obviously did an incredible job of that.
I was also really moved by Dana Atkinson's story, the guy who fixes the strings, and how he talked about finding his place as a gay man who came up at a time when it was really hard to be out in the 70s. But he found his belonging through music, and how fixing instruments was a kind of metaphor for his own life.
I wasn't broken. Don't need to fixing. And so I decided to embrace it. Met my husband, we became dads. And we've been a couple for almost 23 years now. And so I'm still here. Alive. Free to be kind, be loving, be authentic. So, it's not easy being a kid, but we try to make at least the playing of the instrument part as good as it can be.
So talk to me about that metaphor, which is kind of woven throughout here, the idea that broken things can be fixed.
Dana was the first person that we interviewed, and he was the one who kind of made that metaphorical leap of, there's the broken parts inside of us or the things that we harbor that may be broken. And then there's the broken instruments. And the instruments, you know, that's easy to fix. It's in the practical world. The stuff on the inside might take some time. And I think at the core, yeah, it's a movie about music education and the power of music and all that good stuff. It is about that. But I think underneath it all, the kind of like river deep underground of this movie is a message that, you know, we all have broken relationships, broken promises. The world is full of broken things. And these are people that come to work every day in the morning to fix things. They have faith that with enough patience and effort and skill, things can be made whole again.
so much of what we hear about our school systems are that they're broken, right? I mean, my partner's a teacher, and watching this film, he said, finally, something good about a public school.
It's just a question of, what kind of person are you? Are you someone who abandons a broken thing, or do you fix a broken thing? I agree, there's things that can be improved, things that aren't working, and whatever it is, healthcare or politics or public schools. But what do you do? Just walk away, abandon it, leave it by the side of the road for somebody else to fix? Or are you going to lean in? And I think that's what these people call us to do, is lean in.
Chris, tell me more about growing up in LAUSD's music program. You went to LA Unified Schools. How did that music program shape you?
Pretty deeply. I mean, so my elementary school, one of the core memories I have from that experience is going to the auditorium to hear an orchestra not only play excerpts from Beethoven and some incredible classical composers, but they also explained the sections of the orchestra with film music. And so it was not only my first time getting to know the orchestra in that kind of way, but also actually starting to think about film music outside of the context of actually being in a movie. And my middle school, what was incredible about that program is that they really emphasized jazz music as well. We had guest artists like Al Jarreau and Lou Rawls come and do not only masterclasses, but do performances with us. And so, you know, my first time interacting with jazz legends was in middle school, again, at a really young age.
So you think if you hadn't been through this music program through the public schools, you might not be where you are today as a composer and a musician?
100%, because that's where I spent most of my time, right? Like, my parents were incredible at providing me with teachers that I took weekly lessons from, and I went to incredible music schools. But my own personal connection to the instrument came out of a necessity. It came out of the fact that, like, I needed to figure out how to, on a daily basis, process anything that I was thinking about or moving through. And the space that I did that in was at school.
Ben, you have won an Oscar already for your short film, The Queen of Basketball. And you also have a background as a magician, which is pretty fascinating. You were once a world champion magician. There's something almost magical and whimsical about the way that you guys shot this film. The lighting almost makes it look like the workshop is something out of a fairy tale. Was that intentional?
A lot of credit is owed to David Feeney-Mosier, our cinematographer. First thing he did is turn off the fluorescent lights in that room. It's an interesting warehouse. There's no windows. So if you kind of scan through the movie, you'll realize very, very little daylight in this movie. And so as soon as we turned off the overhead fluorescent lights, we were just in these little pools of incandescent sort of golden glow, this sort of caramelized universe of brass instruments and wooden screwdrivers and planes and, you know, old jars of little screws and nuts and bolts. And there's something more to these instruments. They're not simply instruments. And that's why we focus so little on how you actually fix an instrument, because the movie was not about instruments. It was about the vessel of the instrument as a vessel of love that these repair people were giving to these students who they never would meet. And that was the inspiration for the whole visual palette. And if you were there, you would be enveloped in this swirl of love and a real magic and glint in the eye that these people have about what they do. And so when we're making a decision about music or cinematography or whatever, it's all kind of in service of trying to be subordinate to giving you that feeling. You can't be there, but how do we use all the elements of our craft to do that?
So, Chris, you composed the music for this film, and sounds like a lot of it was played by alums who'd come through the music program. And you can see them playing at the end. It's quite heartwarming.
You know, we had about, I want to say maybe like 60 or 70 musicians from the ages of 7 to nearly 70, you know, all LAUSD alumni, and them all being in the same room together was such an amazing feeling. You had, you know, the trombone player who played on Jaws sitting right next to someone who's going to graduate in a few years, or having, you know, these musicians that have been playing on a bunch of scores in Hollywood not realize that they went to the same exact school. There was a lot of connections made in that room during that recording session, and it brought this almost like family reunion kind of feeling to the environment, which is really special.
What are you hoping audiences who see this across California and across the country take away from the film?
How important music education is to just creating good people. When we talk about the importance of music education, I think sometimes the conversation stops when we consider the fact that not everybody's going to become a great musician, or not everybody's going to pursue music, and so therefore why invest in it? And every time we've screened this film, a handful of people talk about how important their music education was to leading them to a profession that has nothing to do with music, but that education was directly connected to how they carry themselves, how they operate in those organizations, and how they reflect on life.
And I also just think, you know, we're in such a celebrity-saturated world. To see these repair people on huge banners plastered all over L.A. Alongside, you know, Ken and Barbie and Oppenheimer and whatever, to know that Porsche Brinker, 11 years old, will be walking down the red carpet behind Ryan Gosling, to me, that's the ultimate, right? To say that this person is just as worthy of celebration. Nothing more you could ever want for as a documentarian.
Ben Proudfoot and Chris Bowers are the team behind The Last Repair Shop, nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary Short. Pandemic, when filmmaker Sean Wong came back home to the Bay Area city of Fremont, he began to turn his camera on his grandmothers to capture their daily lives. The result is a 17-minute loving portrait of 94-year-old Nai Nai and 83-year-old Wai Po, his paternal and maternal grandmothers, who spend their days together and even share a bed where they cackle to each other before going to sleep. Sean joins us now to tell us about his film, Nai Nai and Wai Po, which is up for an Oscar for Best Documentary Short. Sean, welcome to the California Report.
This is truly an honor to be here.
So tell us about your grandmas. They are in-laws, but they have a really unusual relationship. How did they become so close?
My grandmother on my mom's side, Wai Po, she lived in Taiwan for most of my childhood. And her primary role as like a, you know, identity was like my grandfather's caretaker. My grandfather was paralyzed for most of his life, and I never even got to really have a conversation with him. But when he passed away, you know, 12, 13 years ago, she, Wai Po, ended up moving in with us in America. And I think that's kind of when the friendship really blossomed. Both Nai Nai and Wai Po lost their husbands and life partners a few years apart from one another. So I think they sort of found a late stage soulmate in one another as well.
So what inspired you to want to make a film about them?
the catalyst for all of this was I had moved home to the Bay Area after living in New York City for about 5 or 6 years. And that time that I spent at home, which was months and months and months, was the longest time that I had spent with both of my grandmothers under one roof. And I sort of got to, for the first time, get to experience daily life with them in a way where I got to sort of see their everyday rhythms, their sort of quotidian lifestyles. And my presence in the household kind of with them is always one that's so full of joy and life and infectious energy. And all of that joy was juxtaposed with a lot of anti-Asian hate crimes that were happening in our country at the time, but especially in the Bay Area where they live, you know, where I grew up. And it was really that. It was wanting to kind of create a container for all of my grandmother's joy and silliness and humor and vitality for life and humanity, and wanting to share that with as many people as possible.
Well, there is so much joy in this film, and there are some really funny moments. I mean, you capture them like singing and dancing, even arm wrestling. There are moments when they dress up as characters in different costumes and, you know, throw dollar bills down the staircase. And at one point they say, you know, when you're around, there's so much more fun in their lives. Do you think making the film brought you closer to them? How has it changed your relationship with them?
I think filmmaking, you know, forces me to be vulnerable and sensitive and open and curious and honest in a way that is more difficult for me to do in my day-to-day life with my family. And so I think bringing my grandmothers into the fold forced me to bridge the gap between grandmother and grandson in a way that is very human.
What did you learn about them that you didn't know going into this film?
I think to me, it's context. Like, for example, they love eating hard-boiled eggs. That's just like something that's a part of their daily routine. But hearing them say stuff like, we couldn't even afford to eat hard-boiled eggs when we were kids because we were too poor. That contrast of what their lives were like then and what their lives are like now, there's such a huge difference that is so, so, so vast.
Hmm. Well, there's a moment where Nina says, you know, the days feeling pain and the days feeling joy are the same days spent. So I'm going to choose joy. Which is, you know, a really beautiful lesson to hear from someone in their 90s. And this film, you know, is incredibly joyful, but it also doesn't shy away from death, right? You know, you don't have too many more years to spend with them. And they know that they don't have too many more years to spend with you.
We shot this film 2 years ago. And there's a line in the movie where Nai Nai says, I don't need to live that much longer. Another 1 or 2 years is fine. And it's been 2 years. And so I feel very fortunate that not only is she still in my life, but that she's still healthy enough and we get to, you know, experience this once in a lifetime journey together of getting to go to the Oscars and give them this like core memory in their twilight years.
Well, in that moment when you all realized that this film was nominated for an Oscar, they were sitting with you, right, watching the nominations. And that moment was captured on film. It went viral.
Yeah, I like to describe that moment as chaotic joy. It was just so unexpected and surreal. And even now, like, I feel like I'm floating above reality at any given moment. I think for them to, you know, they have no context for this. We were the last film named in our category. And I think after they were like, so are we fifth place? We're like, no, grandma, that's not how it works.
So how do they feel about the film? Like when they saw the film, what was their reaction?
I mean, they loved it. They felt seen, you know, and I think that was our hope with the movie, was to help them and others like them feel seen in a way that I feel like they never get to be. They never really get to be the stars of their own movie. You know, people like them are so often overlooked or forgotten. I think the first time they saw the movie, they felt too seen. They were sort of like, wow, that was amazing. But so many close-ups.
I thought you were going to say they didn't want you to put the fart jokes in there.
There were like a lot of wrinkles. And I was like, no, you guys are beautiful.
How do they feel about getting dressed up and walking the red carpet?
They're very excited. They are getting styled by a few fashion icons, Rodarte and Shirley Corrada, who designed Everything Everywhere All at Once. They have such a playful, creative spirit. And I think nobody really gave them an outlet to be playful and silly and express that part of themselves. And so I think they're just kind of soaking it all up the same way that I am.
Sean, what do you hope audiences will take away from this film?
People like my grandmothers are just as wise and deep and complex and joyful as, you know, anybody. I think you spend 17 minutes with them with this movie and, you know, you sort of get to experience an incredible range of emotions across the human condition. That's the hope to me, is that people realize, like, you know, on the surface, something and someone seemingly very ordinary can have extraordinary wisdom and lives and stories. And all you really have to do is take that first step and listen and engage.
Sean Wong is the director of Nai Nai and Waipo, which is nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary Short. Sean, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you again for having me. I appreciate it.
And that's it for the California Report magazine for this week. We're a production of KQED in San Francisco. This week's show was produced by Jessica Carissa with help from Catherine Monahan. Our senior editor is Victoria Mauleon with help this week from Pauline Bartoloni. Susie Racho is our director and Brendan Willard is our sound engineer. Lucen Mendel is our intern. And I'm Sasha Coca. You can catch all of our California stories on our podcast, The California Report Magazine. Your state, your stories.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.